We've been doing over the last year or two some surveys of Old Testament books and some in-depth look at some of those books. We had a good in-depth look at the book of Matthew. We've looked at Acts. This is the first time we've done one of Paul's letters, and people have been asking for that. I don't know if Romans is a favourite for any of you. It's right at the heart of what the gospel actually means. But unfortunately, it's a book that people tend to disagree about. So one of our goals is to be able to talk about how it's seen differently by Roman Catholics and Presbyterians and Reformed people and others, and yet not to divide up over this book. So as far as we can, we're going to talk about the difficulties, talk about the struggle, and yet try to read it as it would have been understood by the believers in Rome when Paul sent this letter to them, because they weren't divided up over all these things. They might have been divided about some other things. So we'll be diving in and having a look at trying to make sense of the book of Romans like that. As we begin tonight, I'm going to ask you, what is the gospel? If you have a way to write something down, I'm going to ask you to write down your answer to that question. Now, if you have a device and you can't write on the screen there, perhaps you can send yourself an email. So you'll have a copy of this later. Two questions. The first one is, what is the gospel? The second one is, how do we respond to the gospel? And at the end of this course, we're going to ask you those two questions again. So that's why I'd like to see how you understand the gospel now. And then after we've been through the book of Romans, has your understanding of the gospel changed, developed, shifted, or are you still in exactly the same place you were when you started? So what is the gospel? Let's give you a moment to work on that. We're just writing our own answer to the question, what is the gospel? And the second question, how do we respond to the gospel? Okay, got an answer for those two questions? You'll be able to find that again in a few weeks' time to see how you've gone with that. Fantastic. That's great. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Alan Brown. I've been here at Riverview since, oh my goodness, the mid-1990s. Do you have any other questions about how this works before we start? No? I'm going to start with an orientation to Romans, which is on page 5 of your notes. I'm going to take you to the Reformation, because this is a point in the last 2,000 years where our understanding of the book of Romans changed. There was this Roman Catholic priest in Germany, and his name was Martin Luther. And he was doing what most of the Roman Catholic priests did. He was hearing confessions and handing out penance for people to do. And then he would perform the Mass, sacrificing Jesus again for the forgiveness of sins, and then give them a little bit of Jesus' body so they could get their forgiveness. As Luther's doing this, he's using the Latin Bible. The word that is in our Bible is translated repent. In the Vulgate, was translated do penance. And so Luther thought the Bible actually said to do that. And so one of his friends gave him a Bible in Greek. Now, I think you realise the Bible was originally written in Greek, not Latin, not English, okay? So he started reading it and came across this word, metanoia. He said, that doesn't mean do penance. The Bible isn't telling us to go and do something so that God will forgive us. Metanoia is actually a change of perspective. It means changing your mind. It means turning around to go a different direction. He said, I think this is telling us to turn around and follow Christ. And I think that we're forgiven for our sins, not because we did works like the penance that the church told us that we had to do or anything else that we did. I think it is God who justifies us, not the church. And it's a result of God's grace, simply because we trusted him with our faith and not because of the works that we did. This was radical for Luther, because he himself was struggling with guilt. And so this is like 500 years ago, Luther became very vocal, declaring that justification is by faith, that salvation is an act of God, and it's by faith, and it's by grace, and it's not by works. And a lot of the stuff he got from Romans and Galatians. He was troubled in his conscience. He was convinced that justification came from God, was set right by God in response to what we believe, our faith. And so that has become the lens through which most Protestants read the book of Romans. The debate between Catholics and Protestants is still on. In 1964, Vatican II decided that Catholics and Lutherans should get together and dialogue over this topic. And there's been quite a bit of dialogue since then. And there are some Catholics who would have little argument with Luther that God justifies by his grace and not because we earned it. I think many Catholics would agree with that. But there's still some that want to focus on merits. You do these things and you merit God's salvation. And if you don't have enough merit yourself, you can pray to the saints because they're the good people who had some to spare, and Mary too. And you can borrow some of theirs if you haven't got enough. It kind of gets a bit messy. And so we haven't really got all this stuff resolved today. And the book of Romans has been a book that has divided the church. After Luther went his way, there are lots of others who went their way as well. So today we have roughly 45,000 denominations of Christianity. Why are we so divided? Is the book of Romans meant to divide Christians like that? Or are we reading it and perhaps seeing in this book some of the things that we want to see? Is it possible to read the book of Romans and understand it in a way that doesn't divide us into different groups, in a way that actually brings us together? Because I actually think that might have been one of the things that Paul had in mind when he wrote this. See, Paul was not in the debate between Luther and the Catholics, and the people he was writing to were not in that debate either. So maybe it's not about that debate. It might have something to say about it, but Paul didn't write for that purpose. So how can we read this book in a way that will open our eyes to see what Paul was saying to the Christians in Rome who received this letter from him? To answer that question, the best thing to do would be, if it was possible, to go and meet some of them. Do any of you have a time machine? Well, we could travel back to the first century and...
Not with me.
And meet some of the people. Wouldn't that be fantastic? What were they hearing? Who were they? What was going on for them? And why did Paul say this to those people? If we could understand something of the answers for those questions, then we could read it in a way that was fresh rather than in the light of years of argument in church history. We're going to attempt to do some of that in this course. Instead of reading it through the lens of the Reformation versus the Catholic Church, what did it mean to the people it was written to? Well, who were they? Who was it written to? Rome was the centre of the world back in New Testament times. You heard of the Roman Empire? It's like the whole place was under the power of Rome. And so the people who were in Rome saw themselves as being at the heart of Caesar's world. And tonight, as we start the book of Romans, we're reading their mail. Who were they? Who were the people who are actually involved in this book? First question, who wrote the book? Paul wrote it. It was a letter. So one of the things I'm going to encourage you to do is to think about how a letter would have worked back in New Testament times, back in the first century world. Because if we can see how letters worked, then we can probably make sense of the logic and how this actually flows. That'll be part of it. Second question, who was it written to? Chapter 1, verse 1 tells us it was written by Paul. Chapter 1, verse 7, it's written to all in Rome who are loved by God and God's holy people. So it's written to these people who were in Rome. Now, you might think we have zero chance of knowing who these people were or anything about them. But what's really interesting is that as we get to the end of the book, we discover a whole lot about these people. The final chapter of Romans actually names many of them. And just by reading this section, we can see so much about them and enter into something of the community that they were. So, who carried Paul's letter? Don't tell me it was Australia Post. When Paul wrote this letter, he was probably in Corinth. It's probably about 56 AD. And somebody who lived close to Corinth would have taken the letter for Paul all the way to Rome. Who would he trust this letter to? First two verses, I think, answer that question. Phoebe came from one of the ports of Corinth. Corinth actually was on, you know, that isthmus, the bottom part of Greece. There's two ports, one each side, and Corinth is close to them. Phoebe comes from one of the ports of Corinth. So she's in the right place at the right time. She's a deacon of the church, a servant of the church. And Paul writes to the Romans and says, I ask you to receive her in the Lord, worthy of the honor of his people, and to give her any help she may need from you, because she's been a benefactor of many people, including me. So he introduces them to Phoebe as the woman to whom he's trusted the responsibility of carrying this important letter. Aren't you glad she did? Like, if this letter got lost along the way, she's got some pretty serious responsibility here. Now, in Rome, there's not a big cathedral back in Paul's days. There's no St. Peter's Basilica. People are meeting in house churches. So I imagine that what happened when they got this letter from Paul through Phoebe was that Phoebe would go around to each of the house churches and read it to people, because there'd be people in those house churches who couldn't read. Not everybody could read back in those days. So she would read it to each house church. And as they're listening to it, people would have questions about that. And she would have the responsibility to explain what Paul meant by that. So here is a trusted companion and co-worker of Paul going into the different house churches and sharing what Paul has written and explaining what Paul has written. And she knows who Paul's talking to. There's sometimes when he's talking to Jewish people, sometimes when he's talking to Gentile people. And I imagine Phoebe performing the letter, because that's how it was done back in those days. She will look at the appropriate people as she's reading Paul's letter. The next ones that we meet are Priscilla and Aquila. You know anything about them? Husband and wife team. Paul calls them his co-workers because he knows them personally. Now, Paul has never yet been to Rome, but in Acts 18, we find out how come Paul knows them. After this, Paul left Athens and he went to Corinth. That's basically southwest. There he met a Jew named Aquila, native of Pontus. Now, Jews were living all over Europe. And so he is Jewish, but he's living somewhere else. He'd recently come from Italy with his wife, Priscilla. Ah, so Priscilla is the wife. Isn't it interesting that she's named first in Romans 16? Except in this verse, everywhere else they're talked about, she comes first. She's named first because she's the main worker. She's the co-worker with Paul in Christian ministry. And Aquila is the bloke who's supporting Priscilla, the main Christian worker in the family. Why had they left Rome? Well, in AD 49, Emperor Claudius had ordered all the Jews out of Rome. We don't really know much about the background for this, but usually what happened was an emperor would be in trouble for something that wasn't going very well, and he'd try to find a scapegoat. And I imagine the Jewish people were the scapegoats for this particular one. Later on, it was the Christians who were the scapegoats under Nero, right? So this wasn't unusual for him to try to find some scapegoats, but he had actually ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. So Priscilla and her husband Aquila had left Rome, and Paul had met them in Corinth as a result. I told you we knew a bit about these people and their connections with Paul and who they are. That's interesting. We will come back to this, but clearly they've arrived back in Rome at the time when Paul writes this letter. So Claudius's edict was about 49 AD. Paul wrote this letter about 56 AD. In that time, Claudius had died, and the Jews are able to start making their way back to Rome again. That's going to be important for the letter. And apparently, they run one of the house churches. Then he goes on to talk about others, like his dear friend. I don't know where on earth he met this guy, but he's one of Paul's first converts to Christ in the province of Asia. That's Asia Minor, what we call Turkey today. And then Mary, sounds like she's got a Jewish name, would have been Miriam in Hebrew. Then it talks about Andronicus and Junia, who are also Jewish, So they've come back as well and have been in prison with me. They are outstanding among the apostles. Now, what's incredibly interesting about this is that there are apostles in the church in Rome. Andronicus is one of them, and Junia is another one. That's a woman's name. Junia is an outstanding apostle in the church in Rome. How many of these significant leaders are women in Romans 6:8? Like, so many of them. The ministry is being shared between the men and the women. It wasn't like that back in Judaism, and it hasn't been like that through the whole of church history. But this is what the church in Rome was actually like. There are Jewish men and women who are participating in this ministry and have roles of leadership, like Priscilla did, like Phoebe did, and Junia is outstanding as an apostle amongst the leaders of the church in Rome. I love this chapter. Do you feel like you can know these people? And then he talks about several others here, and there's those who belong to the household of Aristobulus, which is another Jewish name. Household? I wonder if this is another house church, because there's a bunch who belong to this. There's Herodian, another fellow Jew. There's the household of Narcissus, so perhaps this is another house church. Tryphia, Phrygia, the women who work hard in the Lord. Rufus, Rufus's mother is important. Look, there's just so many of these people, men and women, that you can gradually get to know. Now, back in their time, most of them would have recognized these names and where those names come from. I've highlighted a lot of the ones who had Jewish names, but there are others in these lists who have Greek names and Roman names. So now we understand something of the demographics of the church in Rome. Some of them are Jewish, some of them are Gentile. I can count about 5 house churches that are meeting together. Each one would have had probably no more than about 20-something people. Now, it might not be a complete list, but I would suggest to you that the number of Christians in Rome at this time is probably between 100 and 200 people. That's what Scott McKnight suggests, those who've studied this stuff. So we're talking about a city of 1 million people and maybe 100 to 200 Christians. Oh, would you call that a minority group? So we're gradually getting to know these people. I wonder how the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians were getting on, given that they're living in a city where the Jews have been kicked out. There's a lot of animosity against Jewish people. Try to think about the dynamics of how this would have worked. In the early days of the church in Rome, it would have primarily been the Jewish people who came to faith in Jesus as the Jewish Messiah and who had a very good understanding of all the Old Testament scriptures, the Torah and the prophets, and who would have been able to teach this stuff because they had the background in that. And it would have been the Jewish Christians who were leading the churches. And then Claudius kicks all the Jews out. And you've obviously got some Gentiles who are left, and suddenly they have to run the churches without the Jews, without the Jewish background, without the Jewish culture, without the way it's always been done. They have to step up and take leadership in the church. And now the Jews are coming back again into the church, and they are finding that some of these Gentiles are not leading the church according to the Jewish customs and culture. Maybe not even according to what the Torah said they should do. So these Gentiles found that they could run the church and don't need the Jewish people. The Jewish people think that they should be the ones who are leading the church and don't see the Gentiles behaving as Jews according to the culture of the people of God. And so you've got this animosity. You see that animosity happening in the book of Galatians, and it's in Philippians, it's in several of Paul's letters. But in the culture in Rome, where Jews have been kicked out and come back, this is a serious issue. So as we go through the book of Romans, we're going to be looking for Paul addressing that issue. And we're going to find it when we get to the 2 chapters before this one, Romans 14 and 15. Paul has some stuff to say in those chapters about what you eat. There are some who think they can eat anything, while there's others who think they should only be eating kosher food. Who's who? Which group's which? Gentiles and Jews? The Jewish people particularly be so aware that at the marketplace, the meat that's on sale has probably been killed at the temples and may have been offered to the gods, and eating food that's been offered to idols, I'd prefer to be a vegetarian. So when Paul talks about those who think they can eat anything and those who eat only vegetables because they don't want to eat that defiled meat that's been offered to idols, it's the Jew-Gentile distinction. And Paul uses the term strong and weak in chapters 14 and 15. Except the one whose faith is weak without quarrelling over disputable matters. And then in the next chapter, you who are strong ought to bear the failings of the weak. It's definitely two different groups within the church in Rome that Paul is wanting to pull together and deal with the animosity that they're feeling towards each other. In Paul's framework, the strong are actually the Gentiles who know they don't have to live by Jewish culture. They don't have to become Jews, subject to the Torah, in order to please God, in order to be the people of God. Whereas the Jewish people, who have these traditions going back in their family for as long as the family memories exist, more than 1,000 years, finding it really hard to say, these are God's people, but they're not eating the kosher foods, they're not getting circumcised, they're not keeping the Sabbath, they're not doing all the things that we thought were the important things to do to be the people of God. And so the weak and the strong, those who believe they can do anything, and those who believe they have to follow the Torah and live by those laws, are at loggerheads within the church in Rome. And this letter is written primarily to address that issue. So the book of Romans is amazing theology, but it's not artificial theology. It's lived theology. The theology of Paul's gospel says God in Christ is bringing all people together under divine leadership in the Messiah. That's Paul's gospel. If that's true, then we can't have one side of the church looking down their noses and condemning the other side of the church because they're not keeping the laws properly. And you can't have the other side of the church feeling like, well, stuff you mob, we can do whatever we like. The question Paul asks in these chapters 14 and 15 of Romans is, who did you have dinner with last night? Because being one people eating together around God's table, sharing your dinner table as God's dinner table with people who are different from you, that's what lived theology looks like. That's the call of this letter. So it's tremendously ironic that a letter that was written to bring people together has actually divided Christians. Can we get around that, folks? Can we learn to allow God to pull us together? And whatever your feelings are, if you feel like you're one of the strong ones and you can do it, if you like to bear with the failings of those who don't have that strength, because you're not strong in order to please yourself. In Caesar's world, the strong can do whatever they like. They can please themselves. That's how politics works. That's how the government of this world works. It's not how the government of Christ works. Jesus did not come into the world going, I'll do whatever I like. He came and gave his life. He did not please himself, right? If you're one of the stronger people, you're called to give your life for the sake of those who don't have that strength yet. And if you feel that you have a conscience that won't allow you to eat meat, whatever it is that's different, that's okay, that's fine. But don't place that as a law on other people in the church too. Don't impose your values on everybody else, because we're not here to please ourselves. None of us lives for ourselves. We are living as the people of King Jesus, under his leadership, as a community that represents and embodies what it looks like to be set right by God in a world that's suffering and divided and at war with each other. So that is where Paul's going in this letter. That's the goal of the letter, to draw people together under Christ. And everything from chapter 12 to the end of the book is all designed to do that. Chapter 12 says, love one another with the love of Christ. 13 says, I know you're still living under the Roman government. This is how you do it. 14 and 15 says, you've got to get together and eat together. You've got to live as one community under Christ. And 16 names the people. That's where the letters go. That's the purpose of how it's to be lived out. And everything in Romans 1 to 11 then lays the foundation from which we are the community that must love one another and exist for the other and not to please ourselves. Tells us all that Jesus did. So that's, I think, how the book of Romans works. What we've done is start at the end and kind of gone backwards through the book. There's a guy named Scott McBride, I'll be referring to him a few times. He's got a book out called Reading Romans Backwards. And he makes the point that Paul knew who he was writing to. All the stuff he wrote in these early chapters, he had those people in mind. So it'd be handy for us to understand what he's saying if we knew who they were to. So we've kind of done that first tonight. We've gone to the end and then seen where Paul wants to take them. And then we can understand the gospel as the message that will take you there, because you know where it's going. Helps to know where you're going when you set out on the journey. If you have questions or comments or thoughts about what we've just done, that little survey of Romans starting from the end.
How does Paul become aware of the friction between the Jews and the Gentiles, as you described there? How would he have become so intimately aware of that tension?
Okay, the question is, given that Paul hadn't been to Rome, how was he aware of the tension between the Jews and the Gentiles there? That tension, I think, was in all of the churches. You can see it in Galatians. You can see it in Philippians, you can see it in Colossians, you can see it in Thessalonians, right? It's in all of the churches, so he's very aware of that. But there's probably people that Paul has spoken to, people he's kept in touch with, who've made him aware of that as well. And I'm quite certain that Paul would have been aware of the edict of Claudius and the fact that that was already a major issue in Roman society, because it crops up in the book of Acts, and Paul is already aware of that. His friends are in Rome, and they've come to Corinth because they can't live there. Paul knows that's the culture. The attitudes that are there in the community tend to be in the church as well. So he probably knows that some of this stuff secondhand to other people, but he's very aware of it, yeah. Good question.
Sorry, I don't know if this is a dumb question, but I've never actually thought about it before. So I knew they worshipped in home churches, like churches. So I always assumed that their little group of friends, family, would get together, which meant, like, I don't know, Jews and Gentiles would be quite separate.
Separate groups.
Yeah.
That would be kind of natural for us to do, to have our own separate cultural group. Paul won't allow it. He says it's not to be that way. You must sit down and behave as one new community under Christ. And the reason is that God has made Jesus Christ Lord of all people. So we can't say, I'll have my little group, thank you, and I'll stick with the people I like and I know, because we must enact the reality that we're one people so that everyone else can get this message that Jesus is Lord of all.
Friction was coming from within, trying to get together.
If they were just separate groups, they might not have had the same friction. Yes, that's right. The friction comes as we try to get together and make it work together. It's really important that we do that as Christians, yeah. It's the pastoral message of the letter of Romans.
The Christian Jews would have been a minority, wouldn't they? Compared to the rest of the Jews. Like, there's only a minority that were in following Jesus, weren't they?
Yes,
there's yeah, a because yeah, the rest didn't believe in Jesus.
Correct. There are many, many, many Jews who don't believe in Jesus, and yeah. Paul talks about that in Romans 9, 10, and 11. Yeah. So we will be addressing that issue, that the Jewish Christians would also have got a lot of flack from others who didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah. Yeah, there's that tension as well.
So basically, Paul is saying that even though someone believes something different, like Jews eating or not eating certain foods, it's a matter of respecting the others and still believing they believe in Jesus, although they don't believe in God, but respecting each other rather than condemning each other. That's what he's saying Paul is aiming for.
Okay, so we've got a kind of a summary paraphrase that Paul's saying you must be together on this. You can't live in judgment of each other. That's not a bad summary of especially Romans chapter 2. In Romans 1, Paul talks about the problems that Gentiles have had by walking away from God. In Romans 2, He says, but if you're sitting there as a smug Jewish person thinking that you've got the right to judge these people, watch out, because you're taking over God's authority too. We're not the judges, God is, so quit the judgment. Yeah, that's a good summary.
And on that, like, where do you draw the line that you're not affirming, like, blatant sin, or, like, let's say they didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah, like, where do you then draw that line?
Okay, so the question is, where do you draw the line with this accepting people rather than judging them? That's a very interesting question. I want to say I don't have to draw the line. God is the judge. God is the only one who reads people's hearts. God is the only one who knows, who genuinely has an allegiance to him, a loyalty to him. And I don't know that about people. I can make guesses about it, but I don't know it. And God has never asked me to step in the role of judge and decide who's in and who's out. Having said that, there are some places in Corinthians, for example, where Paul challenges the church for some of their behaviours because they're misrepresenting the gospel, misrepresenting Christ. So there are times for us to do that. For example, if you saw me thumping my wife physically, I think it'd be appropriate for you to come and say, do you realise what you're saying to all the people who are watching you as a follower of Jesus when you think that violence is the way to solve your problem? It's appropriate for us to have some confrontations about that, but that's different from deciding who's saved and who's not. I think God's the only one who does that. Is that?
Yeah, the question wasn't about saved or not saved.
Oh, okay.
It's like more behaviour.
More about behaviours? It's interesting in 14:1, where Paul says to avoid quarrelling over disputable matters. Are there some undisputable matters too? Maybe there are. And maybe Corinthians chapter 6 would talk about where people have disputes that they're not resolving well. And what would be the behaviours that would be misrepresenting Christ rather than those that are disputable matters? And who decides? I haven't answered the question, but those are good questions. Have we introduced you to the people who received this letter? We didn't have a time machine, but do you feel like you've started to get to know who they are and what's happening within the house churches in Rome? The demographics, the Jew-Gentile issue. Apparently they don't have much of a problem with male-female issue because that all seems to be working pretty well. And there's not a great deal about slaves and masters, which was a huge issue in Rome, but doesn't really crop up that much in this particular letter. So it seems to me that the question about whether Jewish people needed to continue to live by the Old Testament laws and insist that Gentiles do was one of the questions that Paul's always addressing in all of his letters. So it's hardly surprising that it was the pastoral issue he's writing to in a city where the emperor had made the Jews scapegoats. All right, that's a quick introduction to the letter. I think we should grab a coffee break and then come back and we'll begin to read from chapter 1. We'll open the letter.